This is the Yara Crop Nutrition Podcast. Yara is the global leader in crop nutrition knowledge and the leading producer of quality fertilizer products. The podcast is intended to facilitate the transfer of knowledge for farmers and crop advisors, improving farm profitability and environmental sustainability. With Yara, knowledge grows.
Hey, thanks for joining another edition of the Yara Crop Nutrition Podcast. And today we're going to talk about bipartisan nutrition. Yep, bipartisan nutrition. You heard me right. You know, we're in a very divisive era of our culture right now, and people are either going this way or that color or that color. We're going to talk about how nutrition can work together. One element may do something very good for your crop. This element over here may do something great for that crop. But when you work together, bipartisan, you're reaching across the aisle, shaking hands and working together, you're going to inevitably end up with something better. We have Marcus Broughton and Trey Cutts. We're always talking about nitrogen, right? It's that time to apply nitrogen. So you just go out and you buy the cheapest nitrogen you can apply because all you're looking for is pounds per acre. Is that right?
Yeah, interesting. So yeah, I love this notion of almost the unity of in nutrition that we're going to speak to here today.
We're going to bring the country together, guys.
Exactly. You know, normally I guess we're tasked with just feeding the world, not trying to bridge a political divide. I think I'd rather focus on feeding the world than try to bridge a political divide.
It's probably easier, isn't it?
great introduction. You know, I feel like kind of the nitrogen conversation is a conversation that is a perennial conversation, right? It happens every single year, to the point that it's almost this boring conversation, right? There's not a lot new in nitrogen. Most of the time, our conversation really centers around a rate. Or maybe a little bit of a rate range, right? Where we recognize that in the region that I'm growing, the crops that I'm growing, that there is a certain amount of nitrogen that you just kind of need to apply in order to make the crop work, right? And we've all kind of bought into it as an industry. And we all, you know, pretty much believe in it. And if you don't think people believe in that, try to talk them out of a rate that they've subscribed to, right? You know, it's actually quite difficult to convince someone that, you know, you maybe could grow that crop on 15, 20 units less nitrogen than what you've kind of got planned on, right? So this nitrogen conversation has been really rate centric, which, you know, to some degree is fine. I mean, we recognize the fact that there is this crop response to nitrogen, that is, as nitrogen rates increase, so too does the crop response, to some point where, you know, we achieve that law of diminishing returns and it falls off. But the reality is that the conversation around nitrogen really needs to encompass more than just rate. We need to remember that rate, that the crop response to nitrogen is quite dynamic. It's dynamic year to year. It's dynamic even within the season. It's dynamic as a response to different products and that. And we really need to remember that there's, when we're thinking about the four R's, right, that there's actually four R's, that rate is only a single component of those four R's. And when we really start to think about really increasing nitrogen use efficiency and how do we do a better job of allocating this probably most important nutrient when we're talking about crop nutrition, that it's in our best interest to begin to talk about things like, well, what products am I choosing and how am I placing them and what time are they going on, right? So I really think a full orbed conversation around nitrogen management really needs to focus on the four R's. And one of the things I think we really want to talk about today is this component of product, the right product. And I think sometimes as agronomists, purists, right, we almost want to shy away from that piece where we want to just dig into the, you know, the nuts and bolts of crop physiology and soil science. But this component of product is a critical component. We all know that if I'm focusing on urea versus anhydrous, that works slightly different. A UAN in season versus a urea top broadcast prior to planting, that works differently. So this product piece is an important important piece. And I think it's probably really one of the things that we'd want to focus on. So
Marcus, it sounds like these four R's, if we're just talking about nitrogen, these four R's are variables. So it's not the right rate.
Yes.
All the same time. It's not,
right.
you don't say, oh, it's 2020 and it's May, mm-hmm. so I need to put on this many pounds of nitrogen. Likewise, the other four or the other three R's are also variables. So if mm-hmm. I ask you the question, Trey, what's the best type of nitrogen? Is there a right answer?
No. It's an impossible question because it's really based upon location, farming practices, crop, right? You have different nitrogen sources, ammoniacal versus nitrates, and different crops respond differently to those forms. But also when you're talking about the right rate, you can't talk about rate without talking about timing, of course, and source, all in the same conversation. So Marcus, you were speaking into timing. We know the 4R concept lends itself to split nitrogen applications in most crops, right? Because you have a very small demand at germination, through about, the first 30 days, if you're being generalizing across crops. But that peak demand hits right when, most of the growth is going to happen, right? We're not being crop specific here, but we know that the more you can aim your nitrogen application to a demand spike, the more efficient uptake it's going to be. And, the less loss you'll have, i.e. the more targeted rate you can have. But also, in that same conversation is nitrogen source or product. And there are different products or sources, let's say, that behave differently. Nitrates are going to leach faster than ammoniacal, but can be taken up more readily by the plant. So if you time your nitrate applications correctly, you can be very efficient with that application. There's nitrogen inhibitors or stabilizers that help with that loss to zero in rate. But I think one thing that often gets lost in the nitrogen source conversation is how tied nitrogen is to another common element in our systems, which is sulfur. And in fact, when you think about that pair of those pair of elements, leading into our conversation about bipartisan crop nutrition, these elements do different things, but they do the same things. Likewise, like if you think about our government, we're all trying to accomplish the same thing, but maybe in different ways. But at the end, you need both sides of the aisle to accomplish that and work in a synergistic way. And not to get all metaphorical on this podcast, but nitrogen and sulfur is one of the most unique pairs of elements in that there's known ratios in plants between nitrogen and sulfur, right? In that, let's say, corn is, about a 8-to-1 ratio of nitrogen and sulfur, in that for every unit of sulfur, you need 8 units of nitrogen. And that goes up and down across crops, but that ratio does not change. And so, the question we have to ask ourselves is, are we applying that ratio of nitrogen to sulfur, in any nitrogen source that we're applying?
So Trey, to your point, you said, a lot of people know about nitrogen and that there's a direct response, plant response to that. You just said that sulfur is similar or acts similarly to nitrogen. So why do we need two things doing the same thing? How does that play? Why do I even need to worry about sulfur?
It's almost like nitrogen and sulfur hold hands. They do the same thing in that they're, creating the same amino acids or protein structures, but you need both to accomplish that end goal. So yeah, it's a bit of a misnomer to say they're doing the same thing. Yeah, they're creating the same, you know, end products, you know, like chlorophyll and things that help in plant metabolism. But they comprise different elements of those biochemical chains. And that's why you need them in fixed ratios, because, you know, it's the building blocks of plant life. When you're talking about those amino acids and proteins, the sulfur is forming those bonds in those chains. So you can't have one without the other.
Tell me, Marcus, if you can, what is the role of sulfur? What does it actually do?
Well, sulfur, you know, as we've mentioned, sulfur does function quite similarly to nitrogen, right? In the conversion of nitrate within the plant, sulfur plays a role. Sulfur plays a role in protein formation. And sometimes we tend to think about protein as just in a cereal context, we think about protein as like the end result, right? How much protein did I end up within the grain? But we need to be forming proteins throughout that crop's life. The amino acids, cysteine and methionine, structurally require protein, or excuse me, require sulfur in order for them to be made. As Trey was talking about, if we think of these as building blocks, right? You need to have sulfur as the building block to build those two amino acids. In a cereal context, again, that's a crop that I tend to be cereals and oilseeds crops that I tend to focus on. Gluten strength, we know that sulfur plays a role in there. Oil quality and content. In our oil seeds, sulfur plays a critical role there. So those are just a handful of probably the more practical type roles that we tend to associate with sulfur.
Okay, so you sold me. I'm now a customer that wants to put nitrogen and sulfur. And to Trey's point, I know that there's a ratio. So I go out to my extension agent, let's say, or I open up a book that says, this is the crop I'm growing and this is the ratio that I need. So do I just go grab a bag of sulfur and a bag of nitrogen and put 4-to-1 to get my ratio, or how does that all work?
That's a really good question. And to follow up on a comment Trey made, you know, I like this concept of application, right? We need to make sure we're applying these, but it's a step beyond that. It's not about just the application of, we need to make sure that these nutrients are actually supplied to the crop, right? It's not enough just for me to choose and define a rate and go out and throw that product on the field. It needs to get into the crop. And so with these crops that we've recognized that have a high degree of sulfur sensitivity, we have done exactly what you're describing, where we have developed these ratios and we blend product together and go out and apply those. But what's unique is that we're seeing actually higher crop responses when we can actually deliver these two nutrients almost married together in the same granule, right? We achieve higher rates of crop response when these two nutrients are coupled and supplied and applied together. So I think the approach is valid, right? Because oftentimes we get into these situations where sometimes there isn't even an awareness that sulfur should be a topic of conversation. So it's good to start there, but it's also good to evaluate and examine exactly how are we applying those nutrients. Are those nutrients actually getting into the crop?
Yeah, and Marcus, you make a great point. A lot of times, or historically, sulfur has not been in our lexicon for crop nutrition programs, because at least in the eastern part of the U.S., we're getting an inordinate amount of sulfate ion wet deposition in our fields, sometimes totaling about 20 pounds equivalent of sulfur in our cropping systems, which in a lot of cases, you know, 20 years ago was enough to meet the yield demands of the time. But luckily we've cleaned up our air, and, you know, also there's less, say, sulfate contamination in our fertilizers. So it's now a topic of conversation where, a lot of our cropping systems are void of sulfur unless we do something about it. And also you make an amazing point about how we apply nitrogen and sulfur, together. And because they're needed, you know, for the same plant functions, it's important to make sure they get into the plant, you know, in an equal ratio as well. And the issue is when you apply in a blend, you know, either with urea, ammonium sulfate, you tend to get a lot of separation in that blend, either, you know, through the applicator or, you know, just riding down the road, you've got different particle sizes, you know, different weights of particles that tend to separate out. Not only that, they'll throw at different distances coming out the back of the spreader. So oftentimes, you know, you'll get streaking in a field that you'll think is, you know, clearly the operator's fault, but it's just a matter of particles throwing at different distances, no matter if he's on that GPS track or not. You know, there's going to be inconsistencies throughout the field. And what that causes is, you know, obvious, you know, deficiencies and excesses of nutrients to the field. But especially what Marcus was pointing out is that the uptake of nitrogen and sulfur is very key. And what we found when you have those elements together, i.e., you know, holding hands, if we want to be kumbaya, you have when you have a positively charged nitrogen particle, such as ammoniacal nitrogen, and a negatively charged sulfate anion, they basically achieve electrical neutrality, right? You can think of it as opposite ends of a magnet coming together, or in the opposite way of that, if you, you know, don't have those elements married together, they're fighting against other elements in the soil profile to get up. But when you have that electrical neutrality, there's no competition for uptake. And we've seen a really big uptake in nitrogen use efficiency when you have those two elements holding hands and playing kumbaya up into the plant. So
I just wanted to make a point kind of around this whole notion of the reduction in sulfur deposition as being a reason for us to consider sulfur. And that is a truly valid one. But additionally, if we look at what has happened with just nutrient demand as a function of yield over that same time that we were reducing, you know, emissions, that yield has gone up. And so too has our sulfur demand. So it's almost a double whammy, right? Not only do we not have that sulfur deposition, but our demand for sulfur has never been higher as it is today. And so if growers have not been considering sulfur, at minimum, we need to be considering sulfur. And we can't assume that because I've taken a soil test and my soil test says I have a lot, that you do, right? You know, we recognize the fact that sulfur on a soil test and sulfur distribution across the field tends to be highly variable. It's maybe one of the most variable of the nutrients that we test on a soil test. And so simply because you have a soil test that says you shouldn't be worried about it, in my mind, does not preclude the need for the inclusion of that particular nutrient in our fertility programs for no other reason than how sulfur works with nitrogen. It should be part of our fertility programs, just period.
So Marcus, if you're taking these soil samples and it's telling you these are the levels of your sulfur in the soil, and those are highly variable, how do you know how much sulfur you should be applying if you can't rely on the soil test?
That's a good question too. You know, I've kind of evolved my thinking around the use of soil tests. Traditionally, you know, I've almost used the soil test as kind of the primary decision-making tool around my nutrient calculation. Today, I actually start with a knowledge of crop physiology. What is the demand for this particular nutrient in the yield environment that I'm dealing with? And that's what defines that initial recommendation. And then I'm refining that recommendation based on what I learned from a soil test, right? So for, you know, let's say a canola crop, and it has an annual total sulfur need of, let's say, 30 pounds, for example. That's what's in my mind. And then I'm looking at my soil test. I'm going to go, look, what kind of mineralization could I anticipate from this soil? What is the parts per million? I pretty much categorically ignore the parts per million of sulfur on a soil test. But, you know, I can look at things like organic matter. I can look at things like soil texture. What is the propensity of this mobile nutrient in the sulfate form to move through the profile? And almost refine my initial 30 pounds of sulfur required number, maybe a little bit up or a little bit down based on those other attributes on the soil test.
Trey, you said something that got me thinking. And when sulfur and nitrogen are being applied at the right ratio, you say they're achieving this neutral charge in the soil. And so they're not competing with each other because now everything's neutral. Does that also help with the other essential and micronutrients? Does that help them get taken up by the plant as well?
Yeah, you're onto something there, Scott. And it comes back to, you know, what is often preached about nutrient balance. And a lot of times, you know, we get lost in that. What is the meaning of nutrient balance? And we're really referring to that, you know, cation, anion, distribution. I think balance really refers, you know, in a strong way to nitrogen and sulfur because we know the balance that they need to strike. But likewise, when you're overloading your system, let's say with a single source of nitrogen, or, you know, something is out of balance, or you over apply phosphorus or potassium, you know, it's not that, oh, whoops, I over applied certain nutrients. You've now created a space for competition for other nutrients that are needed by the plant. So, you know, a lot of times we think about luxury consumption, but we're not thinking about, you know, some of the basic soil chemistry elements when, you know, you're competing for space on that uptake site. So when you have an overload of cations, then you can limit the uptake of other anions such as sulfur or other cations. So
if these bipartisan parties are reaching across the aisle and grabbing hands, it's actually helping the rest of the room raise their game as well.
Yeah, that's right. You know, government never functions well when it's all Democrats or all Republicans, right? So it takes balance.
I want to get back to the part that Marcus, you mentioned this. Initially, we started the discussion that sulfur and nitrogen were holding hands. And then you mentioned something a little bit further into the podcast where they're not holding hands anymore. They're married. What did you mean by that?
More than anything, and I would say that there's a number of nutrients that kind of function in this manner. Like you just about cannot have crop growth in an optimum way without them working that closely together, right? So I tend to think of nitrogen and sulfur as being married. Phosphorus and zinc, for example, would be another one I would throw into that category. But you really can't have one without the other. And if you've got too much of one, you actually create problems for the other one. Not sure how that necessarily works in their marriage analogy, but there is this symbiosis that must be struck between these nutrients. And sometimes what I sense, and this is looking at this in a very pragmatic way, right, and working with growers in that, where they'll identify symptomology of a deficiency, let's say, and misdiagnose it as a nitrogen deficiency, and it's actually sulfur. And try to correct it by applying more nitrogen. That actually makes the problem worse. In fact, if we're out of balance, you're making the problem worse. You're actually compromising nitrogen use efficiency. One, because you're throwing more nitrogen at the system. But two, your yield is capped. If we think back to Liebig's law of minimums, your yield is capped because of sulfur. Right. So we can't fix this problem simply by throwing more nitrogen at it. We need to approach it in a very balanced way, and we need to be choosing a delivery system that ensures that for every ounce of nitrogen that crop gets, it's getting the right amount of sulfur as well. And that's one of the things that Yarrow-Vera amidus delivers for us, is that every little sip of nitrogen that that crop gets, it gets a little sip of sulfur along with it. And that's, in my mind, that's really what makes the nitrogen use efficiency pop when we start to looking at the use of amidus.
Trey, can you translate that into English for me? What does he mean that this product that Yarrow makes ensures that the ratio is right? Now I'm concerned about this ratio, and I want to make sure that ratio is perfect throughout my whole field, because, you know, I want to make sure that every acre of my field, every foot of my field is producing its maximum. So how do I ensure that? What did Marcus mean by that?
Well, first of all, I don't know if I can translate into English, but I can translate into Southern for some of our listeners. But no, I think what it goes back to the idea of when we talk about a blend and the pitfalls we can run into with almost unpredictable distribution of nutrients mm-hmm. across the field. So, you know, yes, you might be trying to target a perfect ratio in a blend. The problem is once it reaches the ground, it's not in that perfect ratio or distribution, because there's no way to predict that when you have different densities of particles. So the beauty is when Marcus speaks about Yarrow-Vera amidus, it is a homogeneous nitrogen and sulfur product, meaning that every prill that hits the ground has a known ratio of nitrogen and sulfur, and there's no unpredictability of distribution across the field. So when you're thinking about, you know, delivering nitrogen and sulfur together, it almost, you know, it has to be in a homogeneous form to perform as desired. Some of the studies we've done looking at actual measuring nutrient distribution across the space with a blend versus a homogeneous product like Yarrow-Vera amidus, there are troughs and spikes of nitrogen and sulfur across that space. And again, if we think about overdosing and underdosing, all you're doing is driving imbalances, overdosing and deficiencies, which causes you got a uniform distribution, all right, a uniform depression of yields because of that across the field. That's why Yara has really taken to heart the four R's in our philosophy, not only in, you know, the agronomy that we talk about, but in the products that are produced, to provide something that we know has agronomic value and is going to have return for growers. That is based off the 4R philosophy.
So I'm a visual guy, and as you're talking about this, I'm thinking I have a mason jar that's filled with some large marbles and maybe some smaller marbles, and I'm shaking that thing up, and eventually those marbles are going to segregate, right? The heavier ones are going to migrate to the bottom, the lighter ones are going to migrate to the top. So that's one. Okay, I visualize that. I'm thinking, okay, if I put this blend in the hopper, and that tractor's going across the field and it's shaking that mason jar, they're going to separate.
Right.
Then mm-hmm. the other thing I was thinking about as you were talking about that is, okay, let's say that blend is perfect and that mason jar is all mixed up, and I take that mason jar out and I throw all those marbles out of the jar as hard as I can. The ones that are heavier because of physics are going to go further, right? So the lighter ones are not going to get distributed as evenly, or they're not going to be distributed as evenly. Am I right with my visualization?
Yeah. I mean, think about when you try to throw a baseball versus a wiffle ball, you know, what's going to go further? There's just no way when you're spreading at the same velocities that a particle that is heavier versus lighter is going to go the same distance. And that's just physics. So you're exactly right. Even if we somehow had this magic to create the blend that stayed in perfect proportion in the spreader going down the road and throughout, you're still going to get that difference in spreading width. And there's just no way around it. And likewise, with a lot of our blended products, those lighter density particles, tend to break up more than the heavier ones, which creates dust and then really creates inconsistencies in the field and where those nutrients land. So, you know, not only is Yarrow-Berry Metis homogenous, it has a relative harder prill than most of the other in-source products out there, which means even at high spreading velocities, you're going to have an intact prill, less burn, and maintain that even distribution.
So Marcus, we have the marbles that are spread out there fairly uneven. Could you argue that the irrigation is going to kind of move those particles around and it's really not going to matter because in a square foot of soil, yeah, it may not be even, but eventually it's going to kind of get melded together and it's going to be the same?
Well, to some degree you can, but the reality is that that distribution is inconsistent enough with just that spread pattern, right? But it's further exacerbated by the variability in soil textures and how water is going to move within that profile and across the landscape. So we really can't just plan on water evening this all out. For sure, that's an important piece. But at the end of the day, we got to remember that nutrient has to be taken up by the plant. And if we're talking about early on in that plant's life, there might not be a lot of root mass under it, right? And so it's in our best interest to ensure that we're trying to get as much as we can. Let's make sure we're getting a little nitrogen, a little sulfur, evenly distributed so that that crop has access to that particular nutrient.
It's all about making sure it's available to the plant when the plant needs it, right?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Using nitrogen and sulfur together. You've told me that you have a product that can guarantee that ratio is exactly the right ratio on every single prill. What does the research show? What kind of research do you guys look at on a day-to-day basis that shows that doing it this way is better?
Yeah, and I guess to elaborate on Yara's philosophy of bringing products to market that have value starts with agronomic principles and philosophy in a way and crop physiology, but that has to work in the real world, right? You know, and be proven against things like what Marcus was speaking about. Does it matter that, you know, you don't have in the same prill because of things that might occur? And so, you know, we've really concentrated on on-farm large scale research to substantiate this, you know, in our regions across North America. And it really is striking, I think, the gains that you get versus a blended product, right? And we've seen it really consistently across crops and across regions, anywhere from a, 10 to 15% yield bump on, on average. Nitrogen trials are very tricky, right? So that's why you have to do a lot of them and you do them at scale to really understand how it behaves. But, you know, and the other component to that is, you know, we look at things from a spatial analytical view, right? It's not just a singular, strip trial. We really try to put power behind our analysis in our field scale trials, which is important. But when you look at those yield gains and you start to calculate, the unit of yield you get per unit of nitrogen, you know, it's around, a 10% nitrogen use efficiency gain.
Wow.
On average. And Marcus, maybe you can speak to your experiences and, why this is so impactful.
Yeah, no, I would echo that. In a small grains oil seed type of cropping system, that's kind of what we're seeing too, around that 10% increase in nitrogen use efficiency. And I think one of the things that is quite compelling around that increase in efficiency is like Trey indicated, we're often comparing our, Ametis to the grower standard practice, which would be a urea ammonium sulfate blend. And those rates are kind of defined by that grower standard. And the grower standard is he's not trying to cut back on N. I mean, we're putting down the nitrogen that he feels he needs to be putting down to achieve the yields that he's targeting. And we're exceeding that simply by changing the way in which we're delivering the nitrogen. We're not changing the rate of nitrogen. We're just choosing to deliver that nitrogen in a different way. and leveraging this synergy between nitrogen and sulfur embodied in Yara vera medus, and seeing, 10% increase in nitrogen use efficiency, increase in yields, increase in farmer or ROI as well, which is of course one of the things that we always want to be cognizant of. At the end of the day, it's not about just growing more bushels; it's about growing more profitable bushels, and we're doing that with Yara vera medus.
Boy, it sounds like a win-win-win. You're not only increasing the efficiency of the nitrogen you're applying, but you're increasing the yields and the profits. I think that's addresses Yara's mission to responsibly feed the world and do it in a sustainable way. So thank you for helping me understand a little bit about how these two nutrients work together to help each other and to increase overall yields and profits. I appreciate that.
You bet.
Yeah, thanks, Scott.
You've been listening to the Yara Crop Nutrition Podcast. For more information about our company, please visit us at www.yara.com or yara.us, or for Canada, yaracanada.ca.